Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
When you taste food and you say, wow, I really like this cheese, a lot of what makes you have a sense of preference for that cheese comes from your social experiences.
Amy Trubeck studies food at the University of Vermont, specifically maple syrup and artisan cheeses. She talks about her research and what makes Vermont such a great place for small producers. We present part three of Harvest Public Media's Local Food Challenge today. Lemon verbena is the supporting ingredient in two recipes with Daniel Orr, a cocktail and a poached pear. Then how meat gets from southern Indiana's Fisher Farms to the plates of Nick's English Hut. Dave Fisher and Greg Rago talk about how their business partnership started nearly a decade ago. Four news stories from across the food landscape with Luann Johnson.
This week, Indianapolis Public Schools officials approved a plan to grant universal free breakfast and lunch to students across the entire district. This is part of the Healthy Hunger-Free Kids Act of 2010. For IPS to qualify, at least 40% of its students had to be eligible for free meals. This year, 77% of the district's 30,000 students qualified for free meals based on their family income. The free school meals will be offered starting this fall. For once, the mystery behind mass die-offs in honeybee colonies might be getting simpler. At least that's what Harvard researchers are saying after half of the hives exposed to neonicotinoid pesticides collapsed over the course of a single season. A 13-week delay between exposure and death is significant because the bees left their hives behind and mimicked colony collapses seen in commercial hives. Researchers said given a few more months, even the surviving hives exposed to the pesticide would have died off as well. The neonic class of chemicals has long topped the list of culprits in widespread colony collapses over the last decade. Some chemical companies have promoted multi-factor theories to shift blame away from neonicotinoids. Scientists have even suggested neonics could be weakening the bees' immune systems, making them more vulnerable to secondary diseases. Critics, including neonicotinoid chemical producer Bayer, saying scientists applied unreasonably large doses to the doomed hives and used a sample size that was too small. Porcine epidemic diarrhea has already killed as many as 7 million pigs nationwide. One southeastern Indiana hog farm is experiencing a second outbreak of the virus. The repeat occurrence indicates the virus is still a major threat to the industry and is likely to increase pork prices by another 12%. According to the National Pork Producers Council, Indiana is the fifth largest pork producer in the nation, bringing in more than $1 billion in gross state product. And if you've got a beef with beef prices, good news may be around the corner. Purdue University agricultural economics professor Christopher Hurt says we may see prices come down slightly by the end of summer. April beef prices rose to about $5.87 per pound. That was up 11% from 2013. Prices could drop 17 cents per pound over the next few months. But Hurt expects beef prices to remain relatively high for the next couple years, thanks to new demands for corn for ethanol and soybeans going to China. Our website is the place to go to read more about these news stories. Connect with us at eartheats.org. We're making waves on Twitter and Facebook as well. 24/7 food news, recipes, and interviews at Earth Eats.
Thanks to Chad Bouchard and Liz Leslie for these stories, and thanks to Luann Johnson for bringing them to us during the program.
You got it, Annie.
A lot has happened to make locally grown food available for a community to eat. For our series, The Local Food Challenge, Harvest Public Media's Amy Mayer takes us to Northeast Iowa to see one example of a strong local food system that could become a model for others.
The smell of baking dinner rolls fills the kitchen at Decorah High School in Northeast Iowa. Two kitchen workers mix a fresh broccoli salad while culinary specialist Chad Elliott packs up tomato soup. Elliott says most of the food served in the district is made from scratch. Many ingredients come from local farms and dairies.
We're getting a local yogurt now, local beef, locally processed pork. I mean, we can get anything, tomatoes, cabbage, squash, watermelons, cantaloupe.
He started working with area farmers well in advance so they can plant with the school market in mind. And now, a regional food hub that acts as a matchmaker between farmers and buyers makes the connection even easier.
We can call the food hub and they'll take care of it for us. So, I mean, it's really easy to get a hold of locally grown stuff now.
From the launch of the local food effort here 9 years ago, producers have worked alongside buyers to push for a robust system that integrates local food into everyday life. Tom Wehner rounds up a couple of stray heifers at his dairy farm near Waukon, Iowa, about 20 miles from Decorah. Wehner has four daughters, and they all hope to continue in the family business.
We actually were spurred into action in 2009 when we had historic low milk prices for basically the whole year.
To sustain the next generation, Wehner knew his business needed to change. He and his business partners decided to branch out rather than buying more cows. Now, they produce the ready-to-eat dairy that shoppers want, like butter, ice cream, and cheese curds.
By maintaining ownership of the product right to a retail product, we thought it would give us more control over the price of our products.
The WW Homestead Dairy now operates an ice cream parlor in town and distributes products throughout the region.
Homestead Dairy comes in fairly often. It's pretty much the only ice cream that we have on campus now.
That's Wayne Tudor, head of food service at Luther College, which serves about 5,000 meals a day on its Decorah campus. That's a big piece of the puzzle, connecting farmers to a large area business that wants to buy local food.
The goal was 35% of purchases being local, and we hit 36.3%.
Local food seems to be working here. Sales in this rural six-county area reached $7 million in 2012. And in the past 5 years, the local food system has added 50 new jobs to the community, according to a survey of participants. Supporters say it can work in other places too, potentially creating jobs, supporting rural economies, and helping small and mid-sized farms. Nick McCann runs the regional food hub. He says everything here is replicable. The first step is forging relationships among growers, buyers, local governments, and university extension agents like him.
Once that some of that relational infrastructure is developed, then you can start taking some of these next steps in terms of actually creating the physical distribution infrastructure that we have now.
Relationships within a community build the system. But McCann says it's also important to exchange ideas with other places. And he fields plenty of inquiries, especially now that there's so much interest in local food projects. Craig Chase works on local food systems at the Leopold Center for Sustainable Agriculture at Iowa State University.
When you look at all the different projects and all the different organizations that are involved in food system development in Iowa and elsewhere is growing, and in some cases it seems to be growing exponentially.
Chase says ultimately that means more people will have access to local food.
As local food systems becomes more conventional, I guess, in some respects, I think you're going to be able to go to, you know, a wide variety of markets and have it available to you.
And more school children are likely to find local foods on their cafeteria trays. At John Klein Elementary in Decorah, first graders carefully carry that tomato soup and broccoli salad to their tables. Kyle Fai sits with his son, Caleb. Fai says the food is much healthier than he remembers from his school days. He likes the impact it's having on his son.
Because he's a lot more adventurous now with what he eats, and so, yeah, it's been good.
The people of Northeast Iowa may be on their way to having a permanent local food system and a new role, sharing the lessons they've learned throughout the country. Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
Harvest Public Media is a reporting collaboration focused on issues of food, fuel, and field. More stories like this one at harvestpublicmedia.org. Amy Trubeck studied cooking at Le Cordon Bleu Cooking School, but she decided that 60 to 80 hours a week in front of a hot stove just wasn't for her. So instead of cooking food, she decided to study it. Trubeck is an associate professor in nutrition and food science at the University of Vermont. She visited students at Indiana University's Food Studies program to talk about her research with Vermont maple syrup and artisan cheeses. She collaborated with various producers in the state to understand the importance of social relations to people's sensory experiences of food.
Sort of when I say social experience is sensory experience is social experience, that you're, when you taste food and you say, wow, I really like this cheese.
a lot of what makes you have a sense of preference for that cheese comes from your social experiences. So how your community or your natural environment are shaping your actual sensory moment.
Isn't part of the problem then with our food system these days is that a lot of people don't see eating as a social or cultural experience. They're eating in their cars as they're going to or from places. I mean, is that the big problem?
I think that, yes, we don't pay enough attention in general to the sensory experience. I think there are other cultures where social dialogue about, well, what do you think about this food? Why do you think this is good? You know, when you're either within your family or in a kind of a communal setting, yes, I think we pay less attention. I would say that I don't think that particularly in the traditional European puritanical food culture of the United States, you were ever supposed to pay attention. So I would not blame it exactly on eating in your car, but I don't think eating in your car is any help.
Well, let's talk about your book, The Taste of Place, A Cultural Journey into Terroir. What is terroir? Define that for me.
Terroir is a French term that I actually translated as the taste of place, as the way that I thought I could best explain what it is. And a lot of what I talk about in the book is, in fact, because I do research and researchers like things to be complicated. So it's, in fact, an untranslatable term. So, and one of the reasons it's untranslatable is because it's so much about the context of France and what they value in France. But for the American audience, I will say that it is really about the relationship of people in a natural environment and the food that it's made in that relationship between people and a certain natural environment. And it's about the taste, what you can say about how that food tastes and how you can say that that food tastes a certain way because of where it comes from or because of who made it or both. So what the book does is it starts in France and it says, okay, what happens in France? Why is terroir a notion that is considered to be a viable way of explaining what makes you like something and what makes food or drink taste good? In the United States, particularly in the last 30 years or so, the concept of terroir has increasingly become part of the lexicon of people who I call taste producers. So people that are in the work of making food of quality. So winemakers, cheesemakers, chefs, you know, bread makers. There's tons of people that are doing this kind of artisan work now who are very committed to what makes it good, and they oftentimes use recourse to a concept of terroir.
Let's highlight Vermont specifically then. Vermont is a leader in this locavore movement. Vermont was ranked number one in the locavore index recently. So is there something about the culture of Vermont that make it more accessible for people to do this sort of thing?
Well, I think a lot of other places have a lot more potential because they actually have way better land. So, you know, if people would figure out what we were doing and just did it in other places that are not so almost impossible, they're going to do way, you know, I shouldn't be saying this. This is not the artisan cheesemakers of Vermont are not going to be pleased with me if I say this, but, you know, it's hard. It's hard work up there and it's cold, you know, mm-hmm. And so we have very short growing seasons. But I do think that it's more about the collaborations across the system. Everybody knows everybody in Vermont. We only have 660,000 people in the entire state.
Wow.
So it's like one big small town. And then we have we're very politically progressive as a state now. I will say, I mean that in two senses of the term, that we have been consistently voting in what it could be understood as liberal politicians, but we also have citizen-based democracy with town meeting and small-scale interface. So I think that the most important thing to know about Vermont is the citizen democracy part, because I think it makes for a sense of we can make things happen here and we can do it in a community that is very persistent in the state.
Amy Trubeck is an associate professor in the Nutrition and Food Science Department at the University of Vermont. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
I also asked Amy Trubeck what her favorite cheese is, and she said the exact same thing as another cheese researcher we spoke with earlier this year, Rachel Dutton. They both like the cloth-bound cheddar from Cabot Creamery. This stuff must really be good. If you try it, let us know how it is by dropping us an email to eartheats@gmail.com. If you prefer cheese of a vegan persuasion, we have recipes at eartheats.org that will help you make your own.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Break down, baby.
Coming up, lemon verbena in the kitchen.
It's got that kind of lemon pledgy, real strong aroma, real nice.
It smells like lemon pledge, but it doesn't taste like lemon pledge. Daniel Orr will use this herb in a cocktail and as flavoring for a poached pear. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods. Fresh, local, organic food with delis at all three locations and a garden center on East 3rd Street. BloomingFoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels. At the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, one block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness, massage and yoga. More at touchstonewellness.com. And Bloomington Hypnosis, with certified hypnotist and self-hypnosis instructor John Hunkler, helping clients relax into weight loss for health and fitness. Bloomington Hypnosis,
All right, well, time for cocktails.
Beating me to the punch, that's Chef Daniel Orr. I'm Annie Corrigan for Earth Eats. Two recipes using lemon verbena. He grows the herb in pots so he can keep the love growing through the winter. He brings it indoors. This recipe is for a cocktail. Your best bet would be to make a big batch of the simple syrup and then use it throughout the summer in your various drink creations. Now, enough of me. Here's the chef.
So what I've done is, I've taken a cup of sugar and a half cup of water and then put in about 5 sprigs of verbena and a little bit of lemon peel, and we've got a nice lemon verbena simple syrup. There's another step that we're going to take this, make this a little fancy. So we want to put a little sugar rim, and I wanted to make the sugar rim a little citrusy. So what I did is I took about a cup and a half of sugar and the zest from 1 lemon, and I ground that up in a food processor, and then I dried it out in the oven. So you can see I got these big chunks of kind of lemon candy, and I'm putting those into a Ziploc baggie, and then I'm going to smash those down with a spoon so then I can rim my glass with this lemon sugar. Okay, now it's time to make the drink. So we've got a shaker. We're going to add 1.5 ounces of vodka. I usually like to use organic vodka or our local Indiana vodka, 1/2 ounce of Grand Marnier or Cointreau, an orange-flavored liqueur. We're going to add 1/2 ounce of freshly squeezed lemon juice. Okay, and then we're going to add our lemon verbena syrup, 4 or 5 ice cubes, and all depending on the size of ice cubes are. Mine here at the restaurant are fairly small, so I'm going to add a few extra. And we're going to give that a vigorous shake. Okay, now we want to rim that glass. So we've got a nice frozen martini glass. I'm going to take a piece of lemon, run it around the glass. Then we take the lemon sugar, put that out on a plate, and we're going to rim the glass. Sugar, so it has a little lemony crunch on the outside. We drop a lemon verbena leaf inside our glass, strain out the cocktail, and there we got our green thumb lemon verbena lemon drop.
We we met farmer Dave Fisher last week. He gave us some insight into how his partnership with his processing facility helps him bring his Southern Indiana beef and pork to nearby restaurants. Fisher couldn't get the premium price for his beef and pork from large distributors like Tyson, so he decided that selling directly to restaurants and local stores was the best move for his business. But the key was to cultivate consistent customers. First step was to meet the people in charge, and he started in Bloomington.
And usually I'd drag one of my kids along, and we would go knocking door to door on the different restaurants.
One of the doors he knocked on was Nick's English Hut. Greg Rago answered the door.
Everybody calls you Rags. My title is I'm a managing partner, owner of Nick's English Hut. It's kind of an interesting story. Dave and I met. We always bought our meat from Ferris Market. We bought beef there for years. Dave came by as a cold call, just walking from restaurant to restaurant, wanting to know if I wanted to buy his beef. And I said, well, Dave, I really appreciate what you're doing. I'd never met him before, but a super nice guy. And I said, Dave, I've been buying meat. We've been buying meat here for 60 years from the Ferris Market. I really just can't stop buying from him. He understood, but we know we kind of had, we always kept in contact. And then literally overnight, several months later, Ferris Market went out of business, which we had no clue that was going to happen. So scrambling around, my wife and I was trying to figure out what to do. And so light bulb came on. Let's call Dave Fisher. And Dave said, sure, I'll work with you. I'll do the best I can. And the rest is history. So I guess we're proud to say we're probably one of his first big customers, and we're very happy with it.
Now they collaborate on the Nick's Burger, a special blend developed by Fisher and Sander Processing just for Rags' restaurant. They also offer Fisher steaks on their menu. They use their beef and pork for their chili, ground turkey for their turkey burgers, brisket and pork loin. All this totals up to 500, 600 pounds of meat per week. I caught up with Rags after the lunch rush.
Well, it's kind of, I think, what all of us really want to do when you have an independent, smaller restaurant, even our restaurant seats 400 people, where you can trust the person that is raising your beef and processing your beef.
And as a chef, he says it keeps him creative. Having a close relationship with a farmer also has practical benefits.
Okay, like, for instance, the beef recall they had last week. We don't have to worry about that.
The way it works from Fisher's end is chefs call him up or text him on Mondays to place their orders. Then he sends that order sheet to Sander Processing, which receives the animals and then prepares all the ribeyes and sausages. Deliver the orders to the restaurants, and that meat will probably get to customers' plates by that same Friday. The challenge Fisher faces is selling all parts of the animal.
You know, I've got so much ribeye, so much filet, so much strip steak, so much sirloin and so forth each week, and I've got to figure out which restaurants those are going to.
Which is what makes his relationship with Rags and Nick's English Hut so special.
You know, I'll call them up and say, you know, I am just swimming in sirloin. Can you put a sirloin on your menu? And they've been super to do that.
So week in and week out, Nick's might change their specials based on what extra cuts they get from Fisher. Since Nick's tries to keep its food under $20 a plate, it's the customers who might benefit the most from this setup.
What I've been seeing is that our high-end steaks are generally in high-end restaurants where it's $40 and $50 a plate. But our burgers are higher than the conventional market, but you know, if Rags might want to add 50 cents, to make it cost okay for him for a burger, I think a lot of people are willing to pay an extra 50 cents.
That's one Fisher product you're absolutely guaranteed to see on Nick's menu every single day. The burger is definitely one of their best sellers.
It's a 80% protein, 20% fat blend. Their fat is very natural. It's got like a buttery type flavor. Their meat has an excellent grain to it. Any steak that you have has great marbling, which means it's a great combination of fat and protein together, which gives it a very unique flavor. Also,
Chef Greg Rags Rago and Farmer Dave Fisher. More stories like this at eartheats.org. Back to our verbena, this time as a partner for poached pears. We took a field trip to Daniel Orr's house in Columbus, Indiana for this dish.
Well, you know, the first thing in this recipe that we have to do is go out and shake the pear tree. So
let's do it.
Let me just go up here and we'll give it a little shake. Hopefully I won't disrupt Miss Wren, who's been politely coexisting with us. There we go.
There we go.
So when they fall, that means they're ready.
Oh, there went the bird.
Hopefully she's okay. Hi, Miss Wren.
All right, so we got...
All right, so now you just got to pick up your pears. All right, and these are little small lady pears. And we're going to use these for poached pears, so let's go into the kitchen.
So we got the pears from your tree outside.
Yeah, right. Okay, and we're going to get right to it. First of all, we're going to peel them, which is very simple, just a vegetable peeler. And this works best for kind of crispy pears. If they were too soft, they would just kind of turn to puree. So this is for those more crunchy pears like a Basque or an Anjou. And we're just going to put together the syrup to cook them in. We're going to use a vanilla bean, which is a seed pod from an orchid. We're just going to cut this the long way and go right down the center of the bean. And you see all these little black specks? Those are the seeds of the vanilla. Okay, so we're going to go ahead and scrape those. And we'll go ahead and just throw the pods in there as well. They have flavor. And so we're going to put them in there. I'm going to put a little bit of crushed black pepper. Get a little bit of spice. Then we've got about a cup of honey. Okay, we're going to put some sliced lemon. And then we're going to use another wonderful herb, and that's lemon verbena. And then I'm going to just cover them barely with water. And we'll bring that to the boil, let them simmer till they're fork tender, and just kind of stick a fork or a knife into them when they're tender. And then we've got our poached pears. All right, and then there's lots of different ways you could use these pears. So you could make a whole big batch of them, and then you could stuff them with either some granola or some goat cheese, or we can do what we're doing today. We're going to do a dessert. Got a little vanilla ice cream. We'll put our poached pear on top. Nice, fresh, local blackberries. We'll spoon over a little bit of this nice syrup. And then we always like to garnish with the ingredients that we used in the dish. So we have some verbena. And that's a lovely poached pear and verbena parfait.
Lots of fun ideas for infusing new, interesting flavors into your cooking. Use our website as the starting point for your inspiration, recipes, photos, and lots of cooking encouragement at eartheats.org. Thanks to everyone who helps make Earth Eats possible, including Aabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Dave Fisher, Luann Johnson, Liz Leslie, Daniel Orr, Betsy Shepard, Amy Trubeck, Greg Rago, and everyone at Harvest Public Media. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, fresh, local, organic food with delis at all three locations and a garden center on East 3rd Street, bloomingfoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels. At the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, one block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness, massage and yoga. More at touchstonewellness.com. And Bloomington Hypnosis, with certified hypnotist and self-hypnosis instructor John Hunkler, helping clients relax into weight loss for health and fitness. Bloomington Hypnosis, 812-200-5005. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. From a beef farmer to cocktails, we try to cover all angles of the sustainable food movement here on Earth Eats. Thanks for tuning in this week. I'm Annie Corrigan.